The Saturday on Beyond the Vibe, I'm joined by Rob Weir of Tigers of Pantang.
The snare drum fell away from me to my left and smashed a window, like a glass, kind of like a glass door. Because this was a it was a back room, but it had glass doors out to the garden, and I wasn't popular. Although it was a complete accident, you know, and I don't think I was asked back. I wasn't a drummer anymore.
I'll leave that. Love potion number nine.
First band which I put together was a band called Trick. We were Spinal Tap, you know, years before Spinal Tap was even thought of. It was our singer was a punk who sang in pajamas. The drummer was a rhythm and blues skiffle kind of drummer whose drum kit separated from him. It's about three songs in. He would sit and play on his drum seat, but the kit would actually move forward. So after about four or five songs, we had to stop the show and assemble his drum kit around him again so he could carry on.
So I'm here with Rob Weir of the Tigers of Pantang. Thank you very much for joining me. I like to kind of start things off by having a look at those early years of a musician. You know, it shapes who they're going to go on and be. So what was that thing for you that made you go, you know, I want to be a musician, I want to be a guitarist? Did you have a moment?
Okay, so early beginnings, I wasn't a guitar player. I started off as a drummer. Mm-hmm. We were rehearsing in my school friend's grandparents' back room. As I was playing the drums, I can even tell you the song. We were rehearsing Goodbye to Jane by Slade. So we were, when was that, 70, we'll have to Google this now, 75, maybe 74, 75, can't remember. And we'd finished, and I got up, get a drink or something or other, and the snare drum fell away from me to my left. And smashed a window, like a glass, kind of like a glass door. Because this was a it was a back room, but it had glass doors out to the garden. And I wasn't popular. Although it was a complete accident, you know. And I don't think I was asked back. So what happened after that? I wasn't a drummer anymore.
I'll leave that.
I think I think we did a couple of rehearsals because I fancied myself as a singer. And then I thought, do you know what it is? It's probably easier to hide behind a guitar of some description. I could kind of play guitar. From the age of about 11, 12, my dad one day appeared with a Spanish guitar, nylon strung Spanish guitar, which was painted in army camouflage colours, hand painted. And I started playing it left-handed, and I thought, this is awful. How do people play guitar? It's almost impossible. Of course, not realizing that I'm right-handed. So when I finally spun it around, a couple of days later, I guess, and thought, this feels a bit more comfortable. and then assembled myself in the lounge next to the lovely stereo radiogram that we had, put the needle in the groove, and started to try and find a note on the neck of the guitar that, you know, that was somewhere near one of the notes on, you know, gosh, what, an Elvis Presley song, or, you know, I'm just trying to think, early Status Quo, or indeed Slade, or something like that. And it kind of went from there, all self-taught, still I'm a bit like a doctor, I'm still practicing. I think as a guitar player, I don't think you should, if you accomplished absolutely everything, and it's a bit like a band's career as well, then you're kind of saying to yourself and to everybody else, I can't get any better, I can't go any further, but, you know, I've gone as far as I can. So I'm certainly a long way off of being accomplished, you know, God loves a tryer, and God loves me because I try. But I've been very lucky in as much as there's been amazing guitar players that have jumped on the Tigers train journey and jumped off again. And maybe I got a bit lazy because these guys were so good. I just needed to do what I needed to do, you know, write songs and, you know, knock out a few chords. I'm very much old school, so I hate whittle guitar playing, and, you know, 300 notes when really three would do. And you just have to look at the great guitar players, you know, of our time, you know, Paul Kossoff and Jimmy Page and, you know, I mean, even Jimi Hendrix, you know, he didn't whittle, you know, he played, you know, some lovely tasteful blues guitar. The whittlers for me are people that, you know, if I sat in my bedroom, room, wherever, shed, and practiced scales endlessly, I dare say I could whittle, but I've got no interest in that whatsoever, because that's rightly or wrongly, sorry all you whittlers out there, but it's just it's my view and my perception. You know, I like to listen to a guitar solo and think, oh, that's a bit nice, you know.
I think it's got a bit more character, isn't it?
Absolutely. It is the old adage, less is more, it really is. I've always thought that. I'm just going to move the camera a little bit further along there so I can reach behind me, and I've got a rather nice glass of Chardonnay here. Cheers to all the listeners and the viewers.
I think growing up, everybody has that first band or first musician that they really connect with. It's like their band, isn't it? Did you have one in particular for you that was like, this is my band?
No, not really. No.
Was there like just a few in circulation for you that you were like, this is my kind of thing?
I've got two sisters, which are 10 and 12 years older than me. I mean, by the time I was 8, they'd kind of left home. But from a very tender age, you know, coming out of their mono dancet record players, you know, playing 45s, you know, six or seven of them all stacked up waiting to be dropped down to play, the house was just filled with music. Although my dad was a doctor and a surgeon, he was one heck of a piano player. Although if you asked him if he could play piano, he would say, oh, a little bit, you know, I can play a bit by ear, but you could, you know, he could hear a song on the radio and then play it. So the story goes, when he was at King's College in Dublin, as a medical you know, student, he had his own little dance band, and he used to play trumpet and saxophone and musical director and all that kind of stuff. So there's definitely a bit of music in the family. But you know, my sisters, that there would be Elvis, there would be Little Richard, there would be the Beatles, there would be Cliff Richard, there would be all sorts, you know, the Beatles and the Stones and all sorts of stuff, you know, belting out of their rooms in competition, you know, with each other. And at a young age, as indeed we all are, whether it's music or whether it's technology or whether it's mathematics or English, you know, kids are sponges and they take in all this information subconsciously, probably a lot of the time. But if it's the path that you want to take, then it stores itself for use in potential use in later life, which it certainly did with me. I have fantastic memories of listening to all that cacophony of different styles and all that kind of stuff. And I've got quite a wide eclectic taste in music, from Yehudi Menuhin. Now I'm going to get his name wrong. Oh my God, Yehudi. He was a gypsy violin player. Yehudi Menuhin. I can't remember his surname. That's wrong. That's going to give people a laugh. You'll have to Google that. I actually went out and bought one of his early records. And absolutely tremendous, from that to, you know, Rammstein and everything in between, you know. I love a bit of the Rams, the old Rammsteins, a bit of Du Hast. Oh my goodness. Clever written songs. And you've got to tip your hat off to those boys, because they're not singing in English, which is the international language, of course. They're singing in German. And they've taken on all the biggies and kind of, you know, won the battle. Songs are well crafted, and the diction in the vocals is just stupendous. It's just absolutely awesome. Which gives the music its character, really. I just think they're a very clever, entertaining musical act. You go for the music, you go there for the volume, for the vibe, and one hell of a show. Tremendous. Anyway, I digress. So,
Of course, the Tigers of Pantang were formed around that kind of new wave of British heavy metal scene that was kind of kicking off.
Well, I started the band in 78, so it wasn't written about until 79 in the Sounds Music paper. So I think it was late 77, probably. And just prior to Tigers, my first band, I've only ever been in two bands, really. A couple of projects, but two actual kind of performing bands. And my first band, which I put together, was a band called Trick. Now, we're talking days before, well, long before, you could whip your phone out and take a video, or, Wi-Fi technology, or text messaging, or computers, or... And I just wish somebody had taken some Cine 8 film of Trick, because we were Spinal Tap, years before Spinal Tap was even thought of. It was our singer was a punk who sang in pajamas. I was knocking out, guitarists in the style of Tony Iommi and Ted Nugent and Angus Young. The drummer was a rhythm and blues skiffle kind of drummer whose drum kit separated from him. It's about three songs in, he would sit and play on his drum seat, but the kit would actually move forward. So after about four or five songs, we had to stop the show and assemble his drum kit around him again so he could carry on. And the bass player looked like he had a walk-on part in Jesus Christ Superstar. And he was into Crusaders and all that kind of funky bass playing. So you've got a funky bass player, a punk singer, a heavy metal guitar player, a rhythm blues drummer, but we were playing Motorhead by Motorhead. We were playing Bastille Day by Rush. We were playing...
That'd be an interesting sound.
Oh, my goodness. I just wish I had that on film. We would have £250 every week on the You Been For Aiden show. It must have been hilarious. But I tell you what, we did all right. We're just playing the pubs as you did back then, pubs and working men's clubs, and you know they were always full. Yes, my goodness. And then it kind of, that was a good grounding because it kind of became a bit more serious after that. And when I put the advert in a local newspaper to form the Tigers, I'd had half a dozen songs written, which all appear on Wildcat. And the advert kind of said bass player wanted, really, to jam, you know, songs of the day and original material. And within about 2 hours of putting an advert in the local press, the phone rang and my mum shouting up the stairs, it's somebody for you. So, of course, it was Richard Laws, a.k.a. Rocky, the Tigers' original bass player. And he said, oh, I'm at Newcastle University, and on the course I'm on, there's a lad that plays drums. Should I bring him along to the, you know? And I said, absolutely. So... instantly, we were a three-piece, and all we needed was a singer. We recruited a singer quite quickly, and off we went, and that's how it all started.
Yeah. Did you have a feeling around that whole new wave of British heavy metal, like that there was something special happening? Of course, at the forefront of that, you were looking at, you know, the Iron Maidens and the Judas Priest, but there were so many other bands around at that time.
Well, there were, you're quite right. And... you've mentioned Judas Priest in the same kind of breath as Iron Maiden. So for me,
a little bit before, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah. So for me, although it wasn't classified, you had, the old wave of British heavy metal, which were Judas Priest, which were Black Sabbath, which were Led Zeppelin, which were Deep Purple, which were Uriah Heep, which were Thin Lizzy. And all those bands that were established probably 10, 12, and so many more years before. Then all of a sudden in 78, 79, you have this kind of, I'm going to use the word explosion, of new rock heavy metal acts coming through. The press got a hold of it. It was pigeonholed because people love pigeonholes. People love, genres and subgenres of music, because they feel safe and they can go to that particular pigeonhole and pick out, oh, that's athletic rock, that's speed metal, that's deathcore, grinds, toenail, you know, clamping, whatever, you know. I'll play some of that now. So thankfully, when I started, there were only a few, kind of classifications, if you like, which all had sub classifications. New wave of British heavy metal was born out of heavy metal music. And new bands on the like on the block, as it were. You know, of which I consider there were four to start with, which were Tigers, Iron Maiden, Saxon, and Def Leppard. We were the four that were written about initially in the Sounds newspaper, and I think we kind of forced open the floodgates for an awful lot more bands, you know, to come through and ride on the wave with us, as you like, you know. Or they all got on the kind of new wave of British heavy metal surfboard, and off we went, you know, crashing across the waves.
Of course, you briefly touched on the debut album Wildcat there. Of course, that was very well received. And then just a year later, you know, after John Sykes and John Deverell joined, you then went on and recorded Spellbound as well. I mean, that in just such a short space of time, doing two albums and then, of course, replacing a singer, that's a lot to deal with. What was that period like for you guys? Was it just a bit crazy, or were you just kind of rolling with it?
I think we were kind of rolling with it, to be fair. Yes, it was crazy, but I don't think there wasn't time to stop and think. You know, we were signed to a major record label, but probably the biggest one, because MCA's parent company was CIC Universal. Which, of course, is, you know, Universal Pictures, which make all the blockbuster films, still do to this day. So they were probably the richest record company. So we were very lucky, you know. We were signed, Lynyrd Skynyrd was signed to them. You know, Spyro Gyra, Poco. There was lots of kind of big acts in the day. They, of course, were signed to the American branch. We were signed to the UK branch. And then, of course, about 16, 18 months after we were signed, they signed Diamond Head. Because Diamond Head didn't have a record deal. Everything kind of happens for a reason. We were just kind of caught up in the moment, as it were. There was, you know, we recorded Wildcat. We went out and did, we played Reading in 1980 to 72,000 people with Whitesnake headlining on the A stage, on Whitesnake's headlining stage. About 10 days later, we went out and did we did the Wildcats headline tour, which was our first headline tour. So bearing in mind, March in 80, we set off, our first show was at Cardiff Top Rank, opening up for Magnum. We did 20 dates, 20 shows with Magnum, opening up for them. We then jumped onto the, chronologically, I'm not sure I'm going to get this right, but I'll tell you what we did, and I'm sure somebody can look it up and sort it out.
Sure, the fans will know in the comments.
Yeah, absolutely. We did. I'm sure the next thing we did, and this was just days off in between, we did the Love Drive tour with the Scorpions in all the big halls in the UK. We then did On Through the Night with Def Leppard. We then did the second half of the Wheels of Steel tour with Saxon. That was 3 weeks. We did some shows with Iron Maiden, and then we went into the studio in the summer and recorded Wildcat, and then came out and did our own headline tour, playing 2,000 capacity venues, which were Top Ranks and Mayfairs and Locarno's, and they were all owned by Mecca, who Mecca used to run a huge bingo empire and sponsor Miss World.
Right.
So Mecca were all powerful, all singing, all dancing, and had all these venues virtually in every single city in the UK. You know, all standing, kind of rock venue stroke, music venue stroke, rock disco nightclub, you know, they were the forerunners to what we call academies these days.
Did you find it particularly difficult? I mean, I find a lot of bands, when you're replacing a singer, there's always that question, isn't there? I mean, you guys have now done it a couple of times, but, you know, it's the voice of the band. I imagine that can be potentially a difficult thing to do.
It can be, and quite daunting. But again, because we'd had a number 13 album in the charts, and we're talking the British charts here, not a dedicated rock chart. So, you know, we slid in at 13, you know, with Gloria Gaynor, David Bowie, Michael Jackson,
a lot of competition.
Or multi-platinum, you know, and here's the little old Tigers of Pantang from Whitley Bay, you know, in there with a hit album. So that showed us a few things. That showed us that our songwriting was credible. Mm. We got the image right. It was definitely all firing on you know, on six cylinders for us. So losing our first singer, when we put the advert in again in the music press, you know, for a new singer, there was no shortage of people wanting to step up to the plate and having a go, you know. And of course, before we did Reading 1980, it was decided in powers slightly higher than me that we should have a two guitar player band rather than a one guitar player band. And the reasoning behind that was because when we'd been out touring with Scorpions, two guitar players, Saxon, two guitar players, Iron Maiden, two guitar players, Def Leppard, two guitar players, that it was a bigger sound altogether. Just after we'd finished, literally after the dust had settled on the last note of Wildcat, this meeting was taking place between our agent and our management, an advert was placed, and we held auditions at Tower Bridge Studios in London, and there were two guitar players that were, you know, head and shoulders above all the other fantastic. Hey, everybody was amazing. Everybody was, you know, could play. That's for sure. But like with everything, you know, sometimes there are, you know, a couple of winners. And one, of course, was John Sykes, and the other was Steve Mann, who, of course, went on to play in Lionheart and MSG, and currently still with Michael Schenker, and had a career producing, you know, in a studio in Germany. So thankfully Steve has had a good career in music. Lucky enough to meet up with him last year at Stone Dead Festival. And we had a bit reminisced, a bit crack, which is always nice. John obviously, you know, got the job. We set about straight away writing. John and I, we only ever wrote one song together, which was Take It, oddly enough, but we wrote separately, albeit probably 2 miles apart, brought our songs to the Tigers table, and Spellbound was half mine, half his. Crazy Nights was half mine, half his, with John Deverell and Rocky doing vocals, and of course Brian working wonders on the drums. You know, it was obviously when somebody has to come up with an idea so you can all work on it. It was a band effort, as indeed, you know, it is right up to today. Everybody writes. But in order to write, somebody has to come up with a core idea. You know, you've got to have something to write on or to add to, if you like. So whether that's me or whether that's Francesco at the moment, you know, like it was back then when it was me and, you know, and John Sykes. I've rabbited on that much, I've completely forgotten the original question.
what was your initial feeling around having that potential of a dual guitarist? Was that good for you? I mean, I imagine that there would be some people that might feel a bit like, oh, you know, hang on a minute, I'm the guitarist in this band.
Yes, I'm the only guitar player in this village. Do you know there was probably a bit of that, but there comes a time when you have to admit defeat. And listening to John's guitar playing, you know, the lad was 6 foot tall, long blonde hair, drop dead gorgeous. And played like like Thor. It just unbelievable. And I did think to myself, I'm going to have to up my game here. I'm going to have to go in that room and practice scales for hours on end. No. But then, then the red wine came out, and the white wine. So I didn't. We shared guitar solos. John's were always better than mine. It worked really well, really, really well. John, I still speak to him now. We're still good friends. I've tried to get him back out on the road, trying to get his material out, which is now nearly 10 years old, I suppose. Which I don't think he'll ever see the light of day, unfortunately. We shared a, when we toured around the world, we shared a room together, and got up to all sorts of silly things. He'll forever be in my heart. He's a lovely lad. He really is.
Of course, at the turn of the millennia, you decided to bring back the Tigers of the Pantang. But of course, this time is kind of all new faces. What was behind that decision for you thinking, you know, now's the right time to
the year before, 1999, I kind of walked away from the music business in 87. Sold everything, had enough. After the Tigers, I'd been involved in a couple of projects. Had recorded albums. One was a project called Sergeant. One was a project called Tiger. I'd recorded stuff. We even were Sergeant. I'd gone down to London and got a great record deal with CBS. For whatever reason, which I won't go into because it's all in my book, yeah, which is coming out at the end of the year. Little plug there, called Tiger Band Tales. I just was fed up, and I just thought, you know, what have you got to do in the music industry to get on? I kind of gave in and just, walked away from it all. I still went to shows, which I don't know whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, because when I went to see Thunder on their very first tour, the Little Angels on their very first tour, I just, you know, oh God, I so much wanted to be on the stage doing it. I still collected LPs. And I was, you know, when the CD kind of revolution came around, I thought, no, I'm not buying CDs. I'll buy CDs. I started collecting, and because everybody was releasing stuff on CDs and, and then in 99, out of the blue, I got a phone call saying, did I want to be part of a 20th anniversary reunion of the Tigers? And we'd been asked if we would play the Wacken Festival in Germany. So it took me a nanosecond to say yes. I'll do that. And then I thought to myself, well, I haven't got any guitars, or I haven't played seriously for 87, 97, 98, 12 years. Mm-hmm. So went out and had to buy a couple of guitars, had to buy some amps and some speakers, some stage clothes, and some bike clips. When we finally went out to, you're thinking bike clips, that's a strange thing to, but it isn't really, and I'll tell you why. Because when we went out to, when we were on the plane going across to, four rehearsals. Wow. went out to Germany. And as I was on the second plane ride from Heathrow to Hamburg, I was told that we were headlining the next night, because we went out on the Thursday. We were headlining on the Friday. Saxon on before us, Dokken on before us, Hammerfall on before us. And I thought, oh, my God.
No pressure.
Yeah, no pressure. hence the bike clips. Because I thought to myself, bike clips are a great addition to my stage clothes. Clipping at the bottom of my ankles to hold all the personal wastage that's going to come out of me, because I was shitting myself. So we walked out at 1 o'clock in the morning to 22,000 people.
Wow.
Not having played for 12 years. And you know, it does, the ticker tape runs through the just the top of, across the top of your eyebrows inside your cranium, thinking, can you still do this? Do you still are you going to be all right doing this? Are you going to remember the chords? Are you going to be able to play the guitar solos? Are you going to be, what's going on? Why are you doing this, you idiot? You were safe hiding in your garden shed about 48 hours ago, you know. You know, doing your crochet. Why are you putting yourself through this? There's only so many pairs of socks you can crochet. So and it's, when I came off stage, I just thought to myself, crikey, I need a bit more of this. I absolutely loved it. Seriously loved it. That was it. I decided that I was going to have to put the Tigers back together again in some shape or form. All the original members all had lives doing, you know, other stuff, and couldn't be part of the new crusade. So I just set about recruiting new guys, new members. And you know, the stigma to this day, I don't know what, maybe you're guilty of this, I don't know, maybe you won't admit to it, but when I do interviews with magazines and radio shows, and when people review our albums, they'll say, Rob Weir, only original remaining member of the Tigers.
And I've seen this, yeah.
It absolutely grates the juke out of me. I won't swear because this is going out on YouTube. I was going to say shit, but I won't, because that's a swear word. So but when you read a review of Whitesnake, they'd never say David Coverdale, only remaining member. They never say Mick Box, only remaining member of you. They never say, you know, I think to myself, why are you picking on us? You know, have you got, it's poor journalism for me.
Have
you got nothing else to say? There are certain ways to circumnavigate this. The Tigers have now been going for 24 years. The original band was together for four and a half. So, you know, Jack, our singer, has been in the band 20 years. Craig's been with me 24 years, the drummer. God, I'm very, very grateful and very humbled and very honoured with the monocle, the moniker, I should say, a monocle, something you wear, with a moniker. I need to get one of those. I quite fancy a monocle, actually. You know, with a new wave of British heavy metal, because it's helped, it's served us, you know, in great stead. But you can't just keep playing Wildcat. Well, you could. You could, but I don't want to. The creativity is just ridiculous, you know, in this band. And, you know, the albums that we've produced recently, in recent years, I should say, have all, you know, have sold really well. They've all come to great acclaim.
Very well received. I mean, I was going to mention this, you know, particularly the latest, well, prior to your upcoming release, Bloodlines, I mean, it's a great record. You know, I think you guys are the current iteration that you have now. I mean, I don't know whether I'm going to make a bold claim, but, you know, I feel that, you know, I associate what you guys are today as Tigers of Pantang. I mean, I don't, you know, as you mentioned there, you know, you guys have been doing this now for a longer period than what the original iteration were doing.
Absolutely.
But I do know what you mean with the only member left or something.
Oh my goodness.
I've had this with because I've interviewed a couple of people where they may be classed as the only one left, like Roger O from Foghat recently, and a guy called Fito Della Parra who was in Canned Heat.
They don't say Biff, only original remaining member of Saxon. They don't say Brian Tatler, only original member of Diamondhead. And I get so
for some reason, I don't know why. I mean, I'm there is this thing with particular bands. And I do understand, like, I have seen in comments before as well where it's, I mean, how would you respond to this when somebody goes, oh well, it's not, that's not really Tigers of Pantang. That's not really this. I'm sure you've seen that kind of thing before. I mean, I've seen it with other.
I have. And the response would be, is it really Deep Purple?
Yeah.
Is it really Whitesnake?
Mm.
Is it really Saxon? Is it really? How many more bands do you want? You know, for me to reel
AC/DC.
Off. Is it really AC/DC?
Yeah.
Is it? I mean, you know, just because there's one original remaining member who was the songwriter, that's the important thing. If I was the original remaining member that played a triangle and never wrote a note, I would kind of get it. But somebody that actually wrote the songs steered the ship in the direction that it needs to go year after year after year, then I think that's fairly credible. I think that's fairly credible. So, sorry, journalists out there, but if you are reviewing anything in the future, please don't say only original remaining member, because it's so old hat. It's as old as this hat.
I completely understand your frustration. Of course, you have the up and coming live album, Live Blood, coming out on April 26th.
Which is a career spanning. We felt the time was right. We carefully chose the venue. We went down the day before. It was the Patriot in Crumlin in Wales. Which we played many times, and we went down the day before, ran through the set, got everything mic'd up, make sure everything was working, did a bit of a test, came out and absolutely nailed it on the night. So this there's lots of live albums out there which might not be quite live. There might just be a slight, we've kept the triangle, but we've recorded everything else again, and we're pretending it's live. There might be one or two of those albums circulating with famous names above them. Ours, I can tell you genuinely, hand on heart, me heart's here, because I can feel it kind of beating, because the batteries, I've just put new batteries in. It is absolutely live. What you hear, there's only two guitars, and when one guitar plays a guitar solo, the other guitar is playing rhythm, and that's that. You won't hear anything else. You know, everything was. It is as it is. And you know what? It was. We sent it across to Chu Madsen, who mixed the Bloodlines album, and what a great job he's made of mixing. Mixing the album and, you know, giving us the same sound, you know, that we achieved on the night, you know, in that rock club. Absolutely tremendous. So you won't hear a lake, you know, a complete sea lake of people, you know, that we've borrowed from, you know, Kiss Alive 3 or Kiss Alive 27 or whatever. You know, the audience that you hear are the people that were actually there. which is quite nice. So, you know, it is. we're very, very pleased with it.
I just think it perfectly sums up what you guys are about. You know, it has the energy, it has that kind of classic metal kind of sound that you guys are about. I imagine that you were getting a lot of requests for a live album. You know,
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And as I say, it is career spanning. You know, the album opens with Euthanasia, which is from Wildcat. Closes with Love Potion number 9. The CD, because of time constraints, is 78 minutes. There's a double LP, albeit it's two LPs in one sleeve, which we elected to go for that primarily for cost, if we're being completely honest, but also for packaging and for postage, and you've got to consider all these things. Because what's happened to the Royal Mail? I mean, a first class stamp, £1.27 or £1.25. What's all that about? Bloody hell! I was posting letters with penny blacks on them. I mean, come on, dear me. Anyway. Oh God! Yes. So that on the LP, there's 88 minutes. So there are bonus tracks on the four sides of the record. And although I haven't actually got a CD in my hand or a record yet, I believe they're on the way from Germany. Very much looking forward to. Well, to play the CD, I can't play the record because I haven't got a record player. But I'm sure I can go around to my son's and we'll play it at his house, because his stereo's worth about £20,000, whereas mine's probably worth about 20 pence because I've got a charity.
Of course, you know, with it being a live album, do you have a particular favorite song that you like to play live? Is that like trying to pick a child?
It is really. I mean, every song has its own merit. Every song has its own flaws. A very difficult one. If I was absolutely pressed it probably would be Susie Smiles, because whenever we play that, the place just goes bananas, you know, the mosh pit forms, and we're not a mosh pit band really. And it always amuses me when we play something like that and a mosh pit forms, and I think, oh my word, you know, look at that. I always want to give a guitar to my tech and want to go down and join them, you know, and it looks so much fun. It looks brilliant. Probably that, but I mean, oh my goodness. There's so many, all of them.
No, I mean, I can imagine, you know, it's, you still get a buzz from that reaction. I mean, I think a band feeds off that energy, don't they, that the crowd
gave. definitely. And we really the back of our minds, we wanted to make the live album, so you know, when you put the headphones on, or you put it on the car, or you buy yourself maybe not in the car because you might crash, let's have the setting in you know, probably where you are, because that looks pretty cool, with a candle, and you put the cans on, and you play it, and you close your eyes, you could actually be there. That's kind of how we sort of wanted everybody to perceive it, really. You know, and you, the vibe jumps out the headphones, you know, and messes with your hair and your brain.
No, I completely agree. A question that I always like to finish on, ask every guest that comes on. If you could tour with one band or musician from the past and one from the present, who would they be?
The past probably would be the past. Probably AC/DC with Bob Scott. Probably. I remember a quick little story. I remember being at the Mayfair. They did two nights. The first night was cancelled. Def Leppard were opening up for them. The first night was cancelled because I was with the Tigers manager at the time, and he worked for BBC Radio Newcastle, and he had his own rock show called Bedrock. And he, on behalf of Bedrock, he was interviewing Angus Young and Bon Scott. And I accompanied him, as I did on those, because he got some great interviews, and I've, you know, met a lot of great, fantastic musicians and people back then. And we were actually in the Mayfair waiting for Bon Scott to come, you know, and meet us and take us to the dressing room. And the place went black and you could smell burning. And there was it was an electrical fire and the place just went up. And all the sprinklers came on, and there was doubt as to whether the second night was going to take place because the place became a swimming pool. Anyway, it did. They managed to dry it, like, I don't know, scrape the water somewhere and put it in, I don't know, buckets or throw it out the window. I don't know what they did with it. The second night happened, and I was stood with the monitor guy at the side of the stage. So I'm at the side of the stage looking across all the Marshall stacks, as it were, okay? So you've got to picture this. So the band are sideways onto me, facing forwards where the audience was, yeah, because I'm around the side. So Bon Scott would sing. He did this every number. He sang. When Angus was doing a guitar solo, he walked towards me because I was stood next to the monitor guy. So he walked towards the monitor desk, walked around the end of Malcolm's Marshall 4x12 stacks, round the back where there was where it was his personal roadie, obviously, who had a torch. He had a couple of glugs of neat whiskey. He did five press-ups, like proper press-ups, got back up.
Wow.
Walked back round, picked up the mic, and then carried on. And he did that. He drank the whole bottle of whiskey within the confines of the show, with five press ups every time.
Wow.
Absolute machine. Unbelievable. And I would have loved to have just kind of been in his company and just chewed the fat with him, and, you know, but I'd like to have done it now with what I've seen in the last 40 years rather than brand new, because my questions would have been shit.
I've often said this. I was like, oh, you know, if I could have had such and such a thing, but with the knowledge I know now.
Absolutely. And now touring now, somebody present. Gosh. So many, gosh, so many. If I've got a plug, maybe Rammstein, maybe somebody like that. Just to have a look at the mechanics of how it all works, and why they have, you know, 20 trucks on the road and all that. You know, just because it all interests me, you know, and the show, and just getting to know the boys, and, you know, going out for a pizza and a glass of wine, and just kind of, you know, chewing it all over, as it were.
I know what you mean with the live show thing. I mean, I've always had that curiosity with, like, an Iron Maiden or something, because it's just such an extraordinary live show. You think, you know, how can you take that on the road?
Yeah, I mean, Kiss as well. You know, Kiss have got an amazing show. We were doing Barcelona Rock 2 or 3 years ago. Kiss were on the next day. We did that with Ozzy and Judas Priest, and oh gosh, it was great. It was a great year. we were waiting for our shuttle back to the hotel, and there were four guys stood, and they just looked like four guys from Men in Black, you know, perfectly pressed dark suits, white shirts, black ties, and the earpiece with you know with a coil kind of. And I said to the guy who was organising the shuttles, I said, they look a bit serious. And so, you know, he said, that's KISS security. And I said, KISS security? I said, they don't play till tomorrow. He says, no, he says, they've come in now. He says, and they're just checking out all the vantage points just to make sure that the band's safe. And, you know, if anybody, you know, could bump them off, then they're on it. And there were two huge... Just as we were talking, there were two 40-foot trailers that just came in from Barcelona port, which had the KISS backline and the KISS show, all the hydraulics for the platforms, and that would all come in for the like for the next day, as it were. I just find it dead interesting, you know, all that kind of stuff. As I say, you know, maybe over a, you know, over a glass of wine and a pizza, some of the boys in you know, Rammstein or KISS or Judas Priest, that they might not say, are you the only original remaining member?
Look, it's Rob Weir, the only original member.
Correct. Yeah, and I would position myself, you know, maybe Judas Priest or whatever, next to Ian Hill, saying, "Yeah, I'll sit next to you because aren't you the only original remaining member of Judas Priest?"
maybe that's what he'd say. Maybe it was like we're the only original member.
I did spend a fantastic night. Chatting to Ken Downing, KK Downing. We were playing a festival out in Sweden together, and we flew out on the same flight actually from in Manchester out to wherever we flew to in Sweden. What a nice fella! I'd never met him before in my life, and we were sat next to each other in hotel reception. And he said, "Oh, he said, because I love the Birmingham accent, because I Magnum, you know, Tony and Bob, and oh God, Tony's gone now, and it's such a shame. Bob, I know Bob will be absolutely lost, absolutely devastated, because oh my goodness, we've had touring with them because we opened up for them in '80." And then they opened up for us in '81 in all the city halls. They came on tour with us. With oh God, such a laugh. Anyway, AK, he's just his lovely Brummy accent. You know, all right, I love the Tigers. You know, never seen you. You know, hopefully I can see you tomorrow. I don't know what time we're leaving the hotel now.
It'd be interesting having him say the Tigers are Pantang in that.
He was great. Yeah. He's just going to buy you a drink. And I said, no, I said, that's very kind. Because he bought everybody a drink in the bar. No, that's very kind. I said, because I'm going to buy a bottle. So, and I think that's probably pushing me luck with you. So, I'll buy my own bottle, but thank you very much indeed. But he bought everybody else in the Tigers a drink.
Wow.
Yeah, so, what a nice
guy, Fair enough. Well, thank you very much for joining me, Rob. And, of course, thank for those out there that want to pre-order the brand new live album, Live Blood, you can via the links in the description below.
Thank you very much indeed. Out on, as we say, April the 26th?
Yes, out on April 26th.
And about a week later, we've got four British shows. So if I don't know when this is coming out, but I would certainly, as being the only original remaining member, yes, would love to see everybody come up and say that to me. No, please don't. The show starts in the Continental in Preston. I think on the 2nd of May, we play London on the 3rd. We play Merthyr Tydfil on the 4th, which is my birthday. Oh. Star Wars Day, may the 4th be with you.
Yes.
And then we conclude in Stoke at the 11 Club, which is a Sunday afternoon matinee. So I'm looking forward to that. Never played an afternoon show before.
Really? What, in all these years? Never done...
Never done an afternoon show, ever. No. That'll be interesting.
Something new?
Yeah, it is. And apparently it's taking off. There's a great rock club up in Newcastle called Trillions. Dave Hills owns it, who's a great friend of mine, who recorded all my guitar tracks for Bloodlines in his studio. And he does matinees. He does afternoon shows on a Sunday. And it's chocker, packed. So come on, you Stoke people. Let's be having you. Let's have it nice and full. Whereabouts do you hail from?
So I am literally down the road from Stoneded in Newark.
Ah, right. Okay. Did you come to Stoneded?
I wasn't available, unfortunately, that particular year. My dad was there. So.
Okay.
He got to enjoy the day.
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, if you're passing, it will be nice to see you.
Absolutely. When you guys are next kind of around the area, I'll certainly be dropping by.
Good.
But thank you very much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, sir.
No, it's been cool, man.